I'm so happy to have the privilege to be with you today and to know that this is a national conference means that this isn't a retail business, this is wholesale business, that whatever happens of significance here will impact all across our nation, and for that reason I take this invitation very seriously. Thanks for inviting me to come be with you. Now, I want to begin by saying something nice about you and then saying something that at first blush may not feel so flattering, but it's really a good word. But I had better sort of butter you up before I toast you. My little grandbaby, she's about five now, but when I first had the opportunity to hold her in my arms, somehow I had the impulse to sing a little song to her. And the song says, "I made heaven so happy today, receiving God's love and giving it away. When I looked up, heaven smiled at me. Now I'm so happy, can't you see?" And as I would hold her, every time I had a chance to be with her, that was the way we would log in with each other. "I'm happy, look at me, I'm happy, can't you see? Sharing makes me happy, makes heaven happy too. I'm happy, look at me, I'm happy, can't you see? Let me share my happy, loving smile with you." And we always had that, and then we go and start playing and so forth and so on. Well, the fascinating thing is that as she grew older, after the early words, "papa" and "hmm" and "yeah" and "no," the first sentence with two words that I ever heard her say, "How are you doing, Hannah Rose?" That's her name. And she said, "I'm happy." That touched my heart. Because in a sense, I hope that that little song had something to do with setting the tone, the mood, the spirit, the perspective that she would hold on life. So when I heard her say, "I'm happy," that was as gratifying as when she first said, "Papa." Okay. I'd like to think of you as little Hannah Roses. And I hope that you know that I assume that what is in your spirit will impact not only the religious communities you represent, but that the nation. And I'm hoping that you know that the relevance of that song for you is that you are all recipients of faith traditions, different though they may be. You are the bearers of a legacy of faith. And I'm hoping that you understand that to mean I received something from my tradition which I hold dear, and that I will find happiness as I discover effective ways to give it away. "I made heaven so happy today, receiving God's love and giving it away," which is what I think is the work of Religious Communicators Council, to receive God's love, God's justice, God's mercy, God's truth, and the truth and reality of faith communities as they live in the context of human community. And all of that's given to you as data to work with, and you are called upon to be the recipients of all of it, mix it, write it, however you get it out, video, word of mouth, print, your job is to see that great legacy and give it away. And if you do it well, no, if you just do it, whether it is always at the standard you aspire toward, if you give it away, there should be happiness. So I hope I'm speaking to a group of people who are happy because of the work you do. Now, what I am going to share with you, at first blush, as I said, may not feel quite as flattering, but I'm going to risk that in the course of the telling of the story, you feel okay that having said those first wonderful words, I'm going to read you a story from the good book that I grew up with. And you know that as I read this story, that you really will be expected to identify with the lepers in the story. That's not flattering. But I think it might have some meaning in the context of the story that will help you calibrate your thoughts, your sentiments, and maybe even your artistry as you sit through the various aspects of the program that's before us today. So, you are in the Sunday school class of my first Sunday school teacher, whose name was Brother Rob Pope. And his pedagogy was limited. He would simply either take a Sunday school card and read the text, or he would sometimes take the Bible and read, and then after he gets through, he said, "Now, what did you get out of that?" That's the only pedagogical methodology that he had available to him. Read the text and then ask the students, "Now, what did you get out of that?" I'm going to read the text. It is from 2 Kings chapter 3. And I normally would be from 2 Kings chapter 7, I normally would begin reading at verse 3. And I'm actually going to read even before chapter 7. I'm going to read chapter 6 all the way back to 31. Now, let me give the context. I mean, it's amazing how religious texts can seem to intersect with contemporary, at least names and places. Because the text I'm getting ready to read to you is from a section where King Ben-Hadad of Aram, those of us who are religious scholars who keep our atlas handy so we'll know the region that's referred to, understand that Aram is Syria. So you're reading, this is no one-on-one application, but it is interesting. And also that there had been a matter of laying siege to Samaria. Okay. And that there is a great famine. Okay. Basically, it doesn't take the Tillichian principle of correlation to think of Syria and famine and refugee and siege. That just come naturally to those of us who have the correlating proclivity. Well, things had gotten so bad How bad? That one of the worst stories in the whole Bible follows here, where two mothers covetanted. So severe was the famine. Let me describe. Cannibalism. Your son today, my son tomorrow. That's enough. It's too gory to go any further. And even in the midst of that awful arrangement, not keeping one's word, even with respect to the awful covenant of death. So one mother shares, they devour. The next day, the other mother reneges. Maybe there is that motherly instinct that triumphs somehow. But it's just so bad. It's just so bad that the king is so upset. He says, the trouble is from the Lord. Why should I hope in the Lord any longer? Which sets the story. That's all I'm trying to say. A situation in which in the advanced stage of secularism, there is widespread question as if God is God. Why not? Heck. Doesn't God do something about all this mess? In fact, God may be the source of the mess. And if it's not what God does, the question is raised, is there actually a God who impacts human history? The king says, why should I hope in the Lord any longer? Which is the advanced stage of secularization in high places, questioning whether the God dynamic or the religious enterprise really has anything significant to say in the midst of all of the stuff going on. Because if you did, why aren't you doing something about it? I don't think you can. In fact, I'm not sure that you are. Okay? So all of that's just setting the background for the story I'm getting ready to read and how you fit into the story. I begin reading at 2 Kings 7, verse 1. But Elisha, a member of the Religious Communicators Council, said, hear the word of the Lord. That's appropriate. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, a measure of choice meal shall be sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. Then the captain on whose hand the king leaned said to the man of God, even if the Lord were to make windows in the sky, could such a thing happen? Elijah said, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat from it. Now here's the story, and you can find yourself in it. Now there were four leprous men outside the city gate who said to one another, why should we sit here until we die? If we say, let us enter the city, the famine is in the city, and we shall die there, but if we sit here, we shall die also. Therefore, let us desert to the Aramean camp. If they spare our lives, we shall live, and if they kill us, we shall but die. So they rose at twilight to go to the Aramean camp. But when they came to the edge of the Aramean camp, there was no one there at all. For the Lord had caused the Aramean army to hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army. So that they said to one another, the king of Israel has hired the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to fight against us. So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, and their donkeys, leaving the camp just as it was, and fled for their lives. Now, these leprous men had come to the edge of the camp. They went into the tent, ate and drank, carried off silver, gold, and clothing, and went and hid them. Then they came back, entered another tent, carried off things from it, and went and hid them. Then they said to one another, What we are doing is wrong. This is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, we will be found guilty. Therefore, let us go and tell the king's household. So they came and called to the gatekeeper of the city and told them. We went to the Aramean camp, but there was no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied, the donkeys tied, and the tents as they were. Then the gatekeepers called out and proclaimed it to the king's household. The king got up in the night and said to his servants, I will tell you what the Arameans have prepared against us. They know that we are starving, so they have left the camp to hide themselves in the open country, thinking, when they come out to the city, we shall take them alive and get into the city. One of his servants said, let some men take 5 of the remaining horses, since those left here will suffer the fate of the whole multitude of Israel that have perished already. Let us send and find out. So they took 2 mounted men, and the king sent them after the Aramean army, saying, go and find out. So they went after them as far as Jordan. The whole way was littered with garments and equipment that the Arameans had thrown away in their haste. So the messengers returned and told the king. Then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. So a measure of choice meal was sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Now the Lord had appointed the captain on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate. The people trampled him to death in the gate, just as the man of God had said when the king came down to him. For when the man of God had said to the king, 2 measures of barley shall be sold for a shekel, and a measure of choice meal for a shekel, about this time tomorrow in the gate of Samaria, the captain had answered the man of God, even if the Lord were to make windows in the sky, could such a thing happen? And he had answered, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat from it. It did indeed happen to him. The people trampled him to death in the gate. Now I'm half through. Since I only had 20 minutes, I've already spent 10, 12 minutes. Let me see if Rob Pope's method works. Now, what did you get out of that in reference to Religious Communications Council? Well, remember, the trouble is from the Lord. Why should I hope in the Lord any longer? Dear brothers and sisters, you writers, you communicators, you bloggers, you Twitterers, bless your heart. I hate to say this to you. The enterprise you are in is under great suspect all around this nation. It's really not clear. I mean, what with, are you evangelical? Are you liberal? Are you agnostic? Are you atheist? It doesn't matter. If it's religious, you may be viewed as in an enterprise that's more problematical than promising. Brother Rob Pope at least would ask you to nod your head if you get the point. Therefore, the idea of even talking about leprosy, those of you who are in the employ of such an institution, I don't care how cute you think you are, in regards as you represent religious institutions, you are either scarred, bruised, you know, just throw in a little contemporary, just marred, disfigured. That is, religious employees at high visibility levels, you are not likely to win either the Miss America or the Mr. America contest. And Harvey is not going to make a mistake. None of you are going to make it. That is respect to right now. We are not the preferred institution holding promise for the future of this nation by most people. So that I made heaven so happy today was my way of saying, you know, I really like you. But fundamentally, the rest of the world may view us much more as lepers. But not to worry. You see, a prediction was made. In the midst of all of the things going on, things were really bad. But there was a religious communicator present at the time, which has raised the question, apparently, the President of the United States said that you media people need to at least be impacted by a prophetic impulse. Not that you're going to tell people what it is, but you at least got to ask some questions. I think that's what got into Chris Matthews. I mean, he's always cantankerous, right? But I think maybe what the president had said the night before might have made him a little tougher than he ought to have been. I mean, that he had usually been, which is unusual because he's pretty rough and tough anyhow. But anyway, it could be that the question is there a place for a prophetic impulse in religious leaders who are communicators? Does that call to a prophetic impulse distort your commitment to objectivity? Well, what in the heck is objectivity in a world like this? Because if the media tells you to cover this and your instinct says to cover that, obviously, you are like a prophet. Your job is on the line. What will you serve? The instructions or the intent of those who pay your salaries? That's my question, too. I always have to ask. I go speaking for people. I have to ask, who's paying this bill? And some days I acknowledge that in accepting my honorarium, that I am in collusion with ill-gotten gain. I'm glad to get what I can get, you know. Not throwing opportunities away much. But shouldn't there be in us some of the Elisha spirit that says, although we are viewed as lepers, although the enterprise is one that speaks of a former power within our universe, somehow, a religious communications council needs to ask, is there a place for folks who listen to the voice of the Great Spirit? But anyway, let me say something about how bad it was. It's really bad. And right now it's bad. When I tried to talk with President Catherine Henderson over here, I tried to say I've had several iterations of how bad it is. First, I told her, we are in an epidemic from a disease which I call the Dirty Dozen Syndrome. There are about 12 things that are wrong with America. That we all don't agree what the 12 ought to be, but we all have our list. All the way from immigration, incarceration, inequity, police community relations, family slave trafficking situations, climate change. I don't need to make a list for you. Each of you has your own list. Yes. But then I didn't like the idea of calling it the Dirty Dozen Syndrome. When I make it a syndrome, I mean they may be individual symptoms. Some are affirmed by one side or the other. But when all put together, we really are in trouble. But then I finally came to the fact that, no, maybe a better way to describe what our situation is we are in the midst of a situation of epidemic proportions, which I call the degenerative discouragement disease. You check it out. You reporters. Everywhere you go, people are discouraged because what they've tried to do in their individual areas have not yielded to the best effort they've given. They're single shot folks, one working on this one. But it's a syndrome. If you put them all together, 90% of the people in America are discouraged today. Shaking their heads. Like the king on the wall saying, what are we going to do? That's America today. I mean, Mike McCurdy, who's down at Wesley Theological Seminary, gave statistical data about the magnitude of the spirit of discouragement. And when you got discouragement, you got a nation that is highly vulnerable. My daddy tells the story. He's gone now, but he left me this story. He said the devil had a going out of business sale. So you know it's a story because the devil ain't never been out of business. But then he said all of the weapons and instruments he had sold quickly, lying, cheating, stealing. But there was one that couldn't sell because it was priced too high. They asked the devil, why you put such a high price on this one? He says, this instrument has been so effective that when every other instrument I've had has failed, if I can get this one in, it'll always do the trick. I can make folk do whatever I want them to do. You standing because it's time for me to close? I've tried to be a good communicator, that is to see when it's time. I'm going to close with this story then. The devil says, if I can get folks discouraged and then we'll drive that in, politicians can tell them anything and they'd be happy to hear it. They can lie to them. They can make promises to them, all sorts of things. If I can get this wedge of discouragement in, members of the RCC, you are ministering in a time of serious degenerative discouragement. I want to know from you what you're going to do about it. What you're going to do about it. I hope you will do what the lepers did. You know what they did? Which is finally giving me a chance to tell you in closing what my talk is entitled. The talk is entitled, I'm Glad You Came. That's what the text says. So they found that when they went to the tent, there was everything necessary to bring remediating possibilities. So they, text says, they came and they spoke out to those who were the gatekeepers and says, we have discovered something and it holds great promise for the future of our people. But they found effective ways to get it believed. So much so, until those who were despised and rejected became the bearers of news that had transforming impact. It's my hope that your coming here today and to this conference will make possible a discovery that God is not as dead as we think God is, that truth is not as irrelevant as most people seem like to think it is, but that you've got something to think about, to write about, something to shout about, something to blog about, something to tweet about, that could possibly help save this nation. That's why my speech is entitled, "I'm Glad You Came."